There is a new book out, When Someone Dies, The Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death. It is written by venture capitalist and lawyer Scott Smith. It is considered the first complete and essential resource for dealing with the concrete details that surround the death of a loved one. Not a surprise, the death and dying industry is a for-profit business like any other, and if you're unprepared, there are plenty of financial pitfalls. In the midst of grieving his mother's death, Scott Smith made agonizing, costly, and time-consuming mistakes regarding the execution of her will and division of her assets. If he, a lawyer, was ill-equipped to handle the hundreds of unanticipated and inescapable details, how was the average person to manage? Which is why we have invited Scott Smith to the program this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Again, the name of the book, When Someone Dies, The Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death. I mentioned your personal experience with your mother, and having gone through this recently with both my mother and my father, I assume you found, like I did, that you really never know when it's done. It just keeps going.
Oh, it starts immediately. You know, this was what happened to me. My mother passed away unexpectedly, and we put her, moved her to the funeral home. And the first mistake I made was within hours, the kind woman at the funeral home asked me how many death certificates I wanted, and I looked at her and I said, "Well, I just need one." And she took my hand and said, "I think you need more than that." And I arrogantly said, "No, I just need one." Well, it turns out you need somewhere between 10 and 30 original death certificates, because every financial institution, you know, the people who administer the 401k, the post office, everybody needs an original copy of the death certificate. And the funeral home very graciously provides it for barely at cost. And if you don't get them then, at later, you have to go down to the county and wait in line and pay a fortune to get them. And that, so after that experience and the ongoing issues with settling my mom's estate, I went looking for a resource guide that could help me, and it turned out there wasn't one, so I decided to write one.
It is, I think, interesting in the beginning of the book that you tackle this from the very beginning, which is we all grieve differently. And we all have different ways that we're working through our emotions, because our relationships are all different with those who have passed. And it's impossible to have a one size fits all. But what you talk about is that no matter how you're grieving, no matter how you're dealing with the emotions of losing someone, you still have to deal with this stuff.
You do, and I purposefully organized the book temporarily. So the chapters are basically what you do in the first hour, day, week, month, and year after someone dies. I've also put a checklist at the beginning of every chapter to highlight the very specific things that you're going to grapple with during that time period. You know, I also made the book short and to the point because, you know, when you're grieving, the last thing you want to do is have a lot of text to get through. I want to get you the answer to your specific question as quickly as possible. One of the other things that I did purposefully in the book was to try to answer the perennial questions that always come up. And I put those in separate boxes throughout the book. For example, one of the biggest questions that everybody has is, suppose your sister passes away. She lived like many of us do, paycheck to paycheck, did not have a lot of assets, and rented a house, did not own a house. But when she dies, she owes the credit card companies $35,000. And the question comes up, do I, as her brother, have to pay those debts? And the answer is emphatically no. There are only two circumstances where survivors might be liable for a deceased person's debts, and that is in community property states, where the debt was incurred on behalf of the marriage so that the spouse would be liable after another spouse dies. And the second one is, suppose I change the facts a little bit, and right before your sister passed away, she won the lottery and had $100,000 in her checking account. In that case, if you take the $100,000, in other words, if you take assets from the estate, then you are technically liable to the creditors of that person up to the extent of those assets.
It is, and this is something that comes, really throughout the book of what you are ultimately responsible for. I should note that you mentioned the checklist, and chapter one, there's the first checklist. The first thing in the first checklist and the first chapter is who's in charge before the death. And that in and of itself can be an issue if it hasn't been decided.
Oh, absolutely. And there's an important distinction between who's in charge before the death and then after the death. They're typically different people. If the person who's dying is incapacitated and there's medical decisions have to be made, hopefully the person has put together a medical directive and a power of attorney, giving someone the authority to make medical decisions in the event they're incapacitated. If that's true, if there is someone with the power of attorney, then that person has basically absolute control over the medical decisions. If you're not so fortunate as to have that power of attorney in place, and by the way, I encourage all of your listeners to have a medical directive with a power of attorney for every family member. If you don't have a power of attorney, then typically those decisions are, by state law, given to either the spouse or a sibling. And in many cases, the medical ethicist, the hospital, will have someone there who can help you figure that out. In some cases, hospitals defer to family consensus and let the family decide as a group. After someone passes away, that power of attorney actually stops. And the person who then has control over the estate and the decision-making authority is the executor of the person's estate. And that the executor is typically designated by someone's will. In their will, they will appoint an executor. If a person died without a will, for example, and many of us do, about 70% of the people in the United States do not have wills, because we're all terrified that if I write my will on Tuesday, I'll get struck by a bus on Wednesday. But in the absence of a will, the executor is also appointed by state law, and it's typically the spouse or a sibling. Taking on the role of executor is a voluntary decision, so that if you don't want the job, you can decline it. You cannot be forced to be somebody's executor.
And again, so many different things. I did note while reading the book that more than half of it are things that you have to do in the weeks, months, and even year after the person has passed, long after everyone has gone home, long after the person has been buried, long after the flowers have wilted. And it's interesting because even though the grieving, the funeral, if you will, is over with, then really the paperwork, if you will, is just beginning.
Oh, the paperwork is immense and it's endless. And I strongly recommend people, most important, I recommend you get a good accountant, because the accountant can help you with the taxes that are due. And I'm going to comment on the taxes in a minute. In addition, if you have to go through probate, and probate is the court-supervised payment of debts and distribution of assets, if you are compelled to go through probate, in most states you're going to have a lawyer as well. And there are lawyers who specialize in this. But to your comment, Joe, about the ongoing burden, taxes, there's the old adage, there's nothing certain other than death and taxes. And paying the taxes is just a very complicated process. It can go on for years after a death. And there are basically at least four taxes that you could end up having to pay. The first is, if suppose the person who died had worked during the year in which their death occurred, well, they have income tax due. They have to file an income tax return for that partial year. In addition, if the estate makes money, so for example, let's say someone dies and they have real estate that bears rent, well, as the estate is holding that property and collecting the rent, that is also income, and the estate has an income tax obligation. Also, in the United States, we know that there's an ongoing battle in Congress over what's called the estate tax. And the estate tax is different than an income tax. The estate tax is a tax on the value of the estate at the time of death. Right now, the exemption is about $5.3 million. In other words, estates that are worth less than $5.3 million don't pay any estate tax. However, if you exceed that amount, then the estate actually has to pay a tax on the value of the estate above that amount. And then finally, many states, not all, but many states have a similar estate tax. And in most states, the amount of the threshold for when you have to pay the tax is below $5 million. So those are examples of at least four taxes that someone has to figure out and pay.
I was surprised upon the death of my father, and we were talking about with people and friends about the estate and dealing with the estate, and I heard from quite a few people, I mean, not just one or two, but quite a few people who said, oh, well, thank God I don't have to worry about that. We don't have anything near in my family that would qualify as an estate. And I think there's that thought out there. Yes, there's that estate tax. But when people talk about just the word of an estate, they think you're talking about a wealthy proposition, not just the house and the few belongings that could be in it.
No, that's right. And, you know, one of the first decision that you have to make in terms of distributing the estate is whether or not you're subject to probate. And, you know, probate is, in every state we have sort of three processes. You have no probate for smaller estates. So, for example, in California, an estate that is worth less than $150,000 does not have to go through probate. You can just distribute the assets without going to court. Many states also have an interim thing, which is called simplified probate or probate by deposition. And there you can just file a very simplified notice with the court. You don't need an attorney, and the process is very fast. If the estate has to go into probate, that's a court-supervised process where all of the creditors, basically probate is designed to make sure that all creditors get paid. So notices go out to all of the creditors, and after the creditors have a period of time within which to submit their claims, they are paid, and then the rest of the assets are distributed. While we all try to avoid probate, and I'm going to talk about some ways to do that in a minute, you know, basically probate is a good thing in the sense that if you go through probate, no one can later claim that they have a claim against the estate. So you cleanse permanently the assets that you do distribute once you've gone through probate. You know, we all hear about the notion of trusts and why you use a trust to avoid probate, and it's a very good idea. If you're a married couple and you have a home or you have some assets that are worth, you know, stocks and bonds that are worth something, it's a very good idea while you're both living to set up living trusts. And what you do is you transfer all of the property into a living trust. You continue to control the property as if nothing had happened. But the good news is when you pass away, the assets that are in the trust are not valued for purposes of probate. They are excluded from the probate process because the trust continues to live after you pass away.
Scott Smith is our guest this morning. The name of the book is When Someone Dies, The Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death. I just want to take a brief break to ask you a question, an opinion question, and that is, in the introduction I said, you know, if a lawyer is ill-equipped to handle the hundreds of anticipated and inescapable details, then how is the average person to manage? And, you know, I thought of that even when I was dealing with the medical side of things when my parents were in the hospital and so forth, and you feel like you have to have a team just to navigate that. But I asked the question, in your opinion, is it a good system in the sense of going through all of this, going through the court, realizing that all family situations are different, not all families get along, families can be blended, there are many parties involved. I mean, do we have a good system? Should it be this difficult to navigate?
I think we have a good system, but it's funny you mentioned something. Where the system is most broken, believe it or not, is in our failure as families to communicate. what happens when someone dies typically, and we have no idea where their will is. We don't know if they have life insurance. We don't know if they have debts to third parties that we don't know about. And one of the things that I just urge people to do is, particularly if you have elderly parents, is to sit down and have the serious conversation. Talk about what sort of life support they want if they are in, you know, in medical emergency. Talk about the will. Talk about what they want in terms of a memorial. You know, right now there's a lot of people that are green or environmentally conscious opt for cremation, because putting a body in the ground after having been embalmed is a very toxic thing to do to Mother Earth. But finding out what people want to do with their remains, what kind of memorial they want, it's very important. But equally important is collecting the documents, making sure you have the deed to the property, making sure you know if there are property owned in other states, and putting that stuff in a file where everybody can access it right after someone passes away is critical.
At what point do you know you're done?
That's a good question. Very good question. I think you're really done when you have distributed the assets successfully and when you've paid the taxes.
Right. And of course, I'm just asking about the paperwork aspect, not the grieving process, which of course goes on for a long, long,
right,
hopefully forever. But so once the taxes are done?
Once the taxes are done, you run into problems with transferring real property. Deeds are, very complicated, and you have to file them with the county. And a lot of times there were, for example, in some states where there's a right of survivorship, let's say dad died in 1975 and mom never fixed the deed to indicate that he passed away, so that when mom dies in 2013, you have a deed to the property that still says Joe and Mary Smith as owners. And in that case, you have to go back and not only certify Mary's death, but you also have to prove Joe's death. And so things like that can just, the building the paperwork can take an awfully long time.
When you, as I mentioned in the introduction, you went through this with your mother, and you felt that you made mistakes, and as you stated at the beginning, they started relatively early in the process. When you look back, what were some of the major mistakes that you made?
Certainly the death certificates was one.
Right.
Another mistake I made was in not being fair about distributing the property. I have three sisters. I was my mom's executor, so I had the authority to distribute the property. And my mother had will had provided that we each inherited equally a quarter of the estate, which meant we each owned every asset a quarter. So my mother had a pearl necklace. Well, we all owned a quarter of that pearl necklace. Well, a quarter of a pearl necklace is worthless. And what I wish I had done differently was I wish that I had allowed my sisters to sort of go through and pick out what they wanted and sort of create piles, so that we all sort of looked at our competing piles and said, well, that's equal enough in value that we can share that way. And the mistake I made was actually selling some of the items rather than just letting people divide them up in a fairer way. One of the things that comes up often is, who owns the house? Suppose I have four sisters or three sisters and me, and you inherit mom's house in Toledo, Ohio. Well, the law is very clear. Each of you owns that house effectively 100%, meaning each of you can live in the house, and each of you is liable for the mortgage and the taxes 100%. So what you have to do as a family is you have to reach some kind of an accord and agreement as to who's going to live there, whether they're going to pay rent. And if you can't reach an agreement about that, then you can obviously force the sale through an action called partition.
And, you just said some key words about if you can't reach an agreement. And, of course, when you put in grief, when you put in the relationship that you have with other members of the family, whether they be siblings or whatever, whether it be an aunt or an uncle or whoever is we're talking about, and some, for want of a better term, bad blood, it can all be a very difficult recipe.
Oh, it can be terrible. There are many examples where a dissolute brother has come running in and taken a lot of assets out of the home right after, you know, mom passes away. And it can just generate a lot of ill will among family members.
And so some of those things, as you point out in the book, some of those things are things that you can avoid by following the checklist. But sometimes, you know, no matter what you do, it's going to be painful.
It's going to be painful, and also you just really, you know, a lot of this you just want to exercise practical common sense. You know, if, you know, one of the first decisions you have to make is who's going to take care of mom's cat or mom's dog? And, you know, there are short-term and long-term solutions. Short-term, you just need to make sure someone's taking care of the animal during the first couple of weeks. Long-term, you know, you really need to look at what mom's intentions were. A lot of states provide that you can leave bequests in some form for the care and feeding of an animal. Other states prohibit it. But a lot of this is just common sense and figuring out what's fair for everybody. You know, one of the issues that does come up a lot is, suppose you go back to that Toledo, Ohio example. Well, we all live in California, for example, but the house is in Toledo. Well, who pays for the shipping? Who pays to ship those items out to California?
Right. Big issues. As far as the animals, my mother made it very well known, actually even earlier in her life, that if we did not take care of our animals, that she would come back and haunt us. So it was very clear from the very beginning that was priority one when she passed.
So we have similar mothers.
Yes.
My mom did the same thing with Harry Potter, her cat.
When Someone Dies is the name of the book, The Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death. It is published by Scribner. Scott Smith, a great pleasure, great work, and I thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book, When Someone Dies, by Scott Smith. It's published by Scribner. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.